Welcome to the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, where it's all about slashing your debt, slashing your taxes, and creating a liberated lifestyle. And now, your host, who has a vast collection of vintage DC and Marvel comic books, and ironically lives in Minnesota, where his favorite NBA team, the LA Lakers, originated, Dave Denniston.
All right. Well, you've probably heard about the fact I'm having my latest book, The Physician's Guide to Money and Life. It is available right now. Now, of course, you can buy it from Amazon, but if you want the best deal possible, what you're going to want to do is buy it from me by texting DocBook. That's DocBook. That's one word, DocBook, to 44222. Or, of course, you can go to the website, which is drfreedompodcast.com/DocBook. Now, I'm offering all kinds of bonuses with this. Make sure to check out the website, send the text, and we'll shoot you right over so you can check it out. Hello, my friends. This is Dave Denniston, and welcome back to another episode of the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, a podcast dedicated to helping doctors like you slash your debt, slash your taxes, and live a liberated lifestyle. And my friends, this is another episode where I am delighted to tell you we have another physician here with me. He is a retired from medicine doctor that has spent a lot of time figuring out what is the formula for wealth. So often in this podcast, we've talked about piles of cash. We've talked about streams and rivers of income. And I think this gentleman probably is more on the latter, but I'm sure we'll find out more about that. So please help me welcome Dr. Buck Joffrey. Welcome, Buck.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
Hey, man, glad to have you here. Always fun to have another podcaster, which you have the Wealth Formula as your podcast. Tell us about it.
Well, you know, a few years ago, I was interested in learning about how to invest in things that that were maybe not traditional, the traditional route that a lot of people went into. So I started listening to podcasts and, you know, I found some things that I found interesting. And what I found was there was not one single podcast that really resonated to me personally. I mean, a lot of podcasts in the real estate world, when I'm interested in real estate, were really about flipping or single family homes and, you know, how to get out of the cubicle, all these things that were not relevant to me. I mean, I was making a fair amount of money and I wanted to know how to make even more money. I wanted to know how the rich got richer, and a lot of those kinds of shows out there. So I started Wealth Formula Podcast and decided I'm going to figure this out on my own and I'm going to tell everybody else about it too. And that's how it all started.
That's awesome. Well, it's a hard deal doing a podcast, and you've been at it for a while. I've been at it for a while. I would love to take us back to kind of the beginning for you, Buck. Where did you grow up?
I am from Minnesota. I'm from Minnesota, and big Vikings fan.
Well, there you go. I'm in Bloomington, sitting here right now.
Are you kidding? No way. No.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great day out here today. Had some hot weather, hot May. We had some 90-degree days all this week.
Oh, wow. Well, interesting. I'm from Minnesota. I grew up there. I was a hockey player. I'd still consider myself a Minnesotan, even though I haven't lived there in, I don't know, 30, almost 25, 30 years. So,
yeah, yeah. Man, so you were in Minnesota and you played hockey. Is medicine something you were interested in when you were here in Minnesota, or how did that come about?
No, so here's the deal. I mean, I think in many ways I'm like not the classic story. I am the son of immigrants, Indian immigrants. I was born in the U.S., but my parents came to the U.S. back in 1967. I'm 44, so if you do the math, I was born after that. And I was a good student. I went to BRAC, by the way, if you know where that is.
You did? Oh, man. That's expensive school right there.
Oh, I have another story about that at some point. It was funny, and it has to do with, I went to med school at Northwestern. I started out in neurosurgery at the University of Michigan. And I was doing a neurosurgery residency. But the funny thing was that when I was interviewing, check this out. This is crazy, right? When I was interviewing for neurosurgery, it was interviewing at the University of Minnesota, which I didn't end up. I was at Michigan. I was doing an interview at the University of Minnesota, and there was two other guys there that day, and they were both from BRAC. I mean, how ridiculous is that? Three guys in interviewing for neurosurgery, the one spot per year at the University of Minnesota, and all three of us were from the same prep school.
Isn't that something, Dave?
So,
well, you know, it's one of those things where it seems like either you have some family history, or maybe you got in a little bit of trouble growing up. Were you more the former or the latter? You had some brothers, sisters that made it there, or were you a troubled kid? No, got into trouble. They had to stick
you in. I was a prep school kid who partied like crazy in high school, who ended up going to college and partying like crazy for a couple years, and then woke up one day and said, gosh, I got to get serious about something. And then I decided I liked science, and I was a biochemistry major, and ended up in medical school. That's basically it. And, I never thought about being a physician. My parents, my mom really wanted me to be a physician, but she knew it wasn't going to happen. When I was heading off to Columbia as an undergraduate, and my mom says to me, you know, we're spending a lot of money for you to go to school, and what are you going to do with that? And I knew what she was thinking. And I said, well, I don't know, but I can guarantee you, Mom, I'm not going to be a doctor. So don't ever bring that up. I tried to get my brother to do the same thing. My brother is now a banker. He's in investment banking. But at any rate, that probably set me free and allowed me to come back. And I got interested in biochemistry and started thinking, well, gosh, what can I do with a biochemistry degree in biology or biochemistry, molecular biology? And there's only a few options at that point that you know, most people think of. It's either you're going to be a lab rat or you're going to go to medical school. For the most part, those are what kind of come up if you're high.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent some time in a lab, a couple of labs, University of Chicago, and I just realized that I just did not have the personality for it. I mean, I am a, you know, go high energy, you know, kind of guy. And I just couldn't imagine sitting around a lab waiting for these gels to run and all that. So I went to medical school, and on the way to medical school, this is how I realized that neurosurgery was the path for me. I was listening to the radio, and I heard an interview from Ben Carson, who is now he's in the government now. I don't remember his
HUD, I think. HUD, I think.
Yeah, Housing and Urban Development Secretary. That's right. At the time, he was the assistant chairman of neurosurgery at Johns Hopkins. And he was talking on NPR. They were interviewing him. They're like, wow, you're a brain surgeon. How'd you know you'd be good at brain surgery? And you know, he said a bunch of stuff. And one of the things he said, though, was, well, I was really good at table tennis, so I knew I had the hand-eye coordination. And what? I'm good at table tennis. In fact, I call it ping pong. And the next thing you know, we got to med school and people started asking around, well, what are you interested in? What are you interested in? So I didn't know what to say. So I started saying I wanted to be a neurosurgeon. And sure enough, it just stuck. It stuck. And I ended up in neurosurgery at the University of Michigan for a couple years, and decided that I didn't like the lifestyle or the fact that I didn't have a lifestyle. And then ended up in switching to ENT head neck surgery and went to UC San Francisco. So I had, you know, trained at some good places, and I had, you know, the pedigree to do academics, which I was planning to do. And then one day I finished residency, got married the next day, went on my honeymoon. And on the flight back from Puerto Vallarta, Mexico, I picked up a purple book from a dingy bookstore in a Mexican airport called Cashflow Quadrant. Cashflow, Robert Kiyosaki, and I read it on the plane, and I came back a changed man.
Let me just go ahead and stop you right there, Buck. I'm really curious to know. So, growing up, with your background, and obviously your parents wanted you to do well, and you ended up getting into medicine. What kind of financial education or literacy did you get, or influences did you have growing up?
Well, I didn't really have, you know, so I grew up upper middle class. You know, my dad is an engineer, a smart guy, but he got into the real estate business, you know, right around when I was born in the mid 70s. But he did it the way that I wouldn't recommend anybody do it. He was a landlord. And I knew he made a lot of money because he paid for college, he paid for med school, and we always had nice cars and we had stuff. But I had no interest whatsoever in what he was doing because I thought real estate meant being a landlord. So, you know, that goes back to the whole, you know, discovering Kiyosaki thing. That was in 2008, 2009. A lot of bad things were happening in the economy anyway, but it's not like I cared because I was broke. You know, I was just coming out of residency, so I didn't even care. I mean, I had money to lose. But reading Kiyosaki's work, there was a bell that went off in my head, and it was this, hey, wait a second. I can do stuff like my dad, but not be a landlord. And I can be an entrepreneur, because how many people, actually, you're smart people, really smart people, go to in high school and they think about being in business for themselves. That's not something that usually comes to mind, right? Usually you think about, I want to do this. I want to be a, and usually that's a description of an employee. A physician, usually these days in particular, is a description of an employee, a lawyer the same. Mm-hmm. There's very few times where you have the extremely high, you know, the kids who are doing really good in school, the 4.0 kids, the kids who are, you know, killing it in the SATs, et cetera, and go off to fancy schools. It's very, very rare that those kids say, I want to be an entrepreneur. And
sure.
And so that was my influence. I didn't have that. I was thinking I wanted to be something. And then I think the confluence of Kiyosaki's work and my dad in retrospect really turned me on to the entrepreneurial world.
Interesting. So you got to see your dad growing up. Did you guys talk about money much at all? Or it sounded like things were pretty well taken care of. Didn't have to think about it too much, huh?
Really, we didn't talk about money. It was usually me just asking for money, right? I mean, that's pretty much it. I mean, it's pretty remarkable. I was pretty spoiled in that regard. I didn't really have to do much. I think and that's probably a bigger mystery of how I became an entrepreneur. But you know, I think it's genetic too. And I do have a lot of the traits that my dad has now, and of being a guy who likes to go out there and create things for himself. But I think more than anything, the one thing I'll tell you is, growing up the child of Indian parents, my parents are Indian. He was the one guy who did not want me to be a physician. He didn't say don't be one. He said, I don't understand why you want to be one. And I said, why is that, Dad? And he said, well, I make more money than all the other doctors out there, and I'm not a physician. I said, Dad, it's not, you know, understand, my dad grew up dirt poor in India. That's really poor, right? So that was his only perspective. So I always looked down at him, and I said, well, you don't get it, Dad. You don't understand. I'm trying to do something to change the world here, you know? But that's the way he saw the world. He saw the world as, you know, I make more money. I don't understand why you'd do something and spend all those years training when you could just, you know, do what I'm doing now and make more money than the doctors.
All right. Well, let's take a pause here for a second and go to our commercial break. Well, if you are like some members of my audience, you are committed to being an amazing doctor and succeeding at life. But the truth is, you've never had all this financial training during medical school, and you're just struggling with enough time to do it all. Well, my friend, over 2 years ago, I started on this journey of writing my next book. And it was a book for residents and fellows, and I reached out to a few potential authors, and Amanda Liu joined me on this journey. Finally, it is available, The Physician's Guide, The Young Physician's Guide to Money and life. It is packed with pretty much anything and everything you want to know as a young physician. Millionaire mindset, debt payoff, buying your first home, and contract negotiation. Now, of course, you can pick it up at Amazon or Barnes & Noble or any major vendor. However, if you want the best deal possible, you are going to want to get it from me by texting DocBook. That's all one word, DocBook, to 44222. Or going to drfreedompodcast.com/DocBook. Now, why am I suggesting to do this? Well, it's because I am offering the sun, the moon, and the stars when you buy it directly from me. Because not only will you get a physical copy of the book, for only about $25, $24.95, you are going to get the following as a bonus. Of course, the physical copy of the book, an electronic copy of the book, an audio copy of my other book, The Freedom Formula for Physicians, all of the episodes of the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, over four seasons worth of material, and you're going to get an electronic copy of the newest edition of the Tax Reduction Prescriptions. And on top of that, you're going to get a whole new write-up on my journey in land investing. You're going to get exclusive content on that as I am going forward. My friends, this is over $100 retail of priceless knowledge. Are you ready to pick up this book and all the bonuses and get all that financial training that you've desired? You're going to get it from me by texting DocBook. Again, that's all one word, DocBook, to 44222. Or going to www.drfreedompodcast.com/DocBook. To snag your copy now, text DocBook to 44222. Or going to drfreedompodcast.com/DocBook. And now, back to the show. So let's just rehash your journey again. So you grow up in, here in Minnesota playing hockey, going to BRAC. You go all across the country to different medical schools and residency. Throughout this whole time, Buck, you sounds like you didn't have to worry about medical school debt. So was debt ever an issue for you at any time, you know, with having to move around and do different residencies without getting paid a whole lot, you know, switching from neurosurgeon to ENT and all of those kinds of things?
You know, yeah, I had a little bit of debt because I took, you know, and again, I just sound like a spoiled kid, and I was, and believe me, but I, you know, I had debt basically, you know, because I had to, my dad didn't, you know, pay me for going out and having fun. So I had some debt. And you know, I mean, when I was, you know, done with medical school and I was in residency and stuff, for the most part, at that point I was on my own. So I did have some debt. But you know, the thing is that to me, debt isn't always bad, as you know, and so, bad debt is bad. Good debt is not bad. It's actually quite good. Right now, I have more debt than I've ever had in my life, but I also have more money than I've ever had in my life. So it's an interesting change.
Well, and tell me how you think about that today. I mean, is there a point at which even good debt can be bad?
Well, if you don't know what you're doing, yeah, I think it can be. but here's the thing. I mean, debt, good debt. What is good debt? Good debt is debt that makes you make more money. So it's leverage, right? It's leverage. It's borrowing the bank. And these days, you know, and I don't practice anymore, and I haven't practiced in at all for about a year or so, but these days, I'll tell you that if in business, because I'm really a business guy at the end of the day, that it is virtually impossible to create significant wealth without using good debt. And let's talk about what good debt is. I mean, in real estate, for example, and I know you talk about real estate quite a bit. If you have debt in the form of a mortgage, that can that basically can get paid down by your renters, and then you also come out with some cash flow at the end, and you also end up building equity. That's good debt. That's good debt. And guess what? Not only does that debt make you, you know, do all these things like pay off your mortgage, put money in your pocket, but debt these days is particularly useful because of the national debt. Because right now, the U.S. is in about $20 trillion plus national debt. That can't go on forever without addressing it to a certain degree. The only way you can address that is two ways. One, the country does so well that the GDP just explodes and that we're having massive expansion and we pay off debt. Well, it would take extraordinary growth to do that. The other way you can get rid of a lot of that debt is by inflation. So you can inflate. In other words, what does inflation do? It erodes debt, right? A money, if you owed somebody $100 20 years ago and you still owed them $100 today, you owe them less back then, right? So the government looks and says, we have so much debt, how are we going to get rid of it? Well, we'll inflate. So we're just going to inflate. In fact, it's policy. It's Fed policy to keep it 2%. Now they're saying they're going to keep it. We'll watch it. We'll let it go above 2% for a while. In reality, it's 3% plus at this point. So if we look at our personal finances, how can we address that? If we carry personal debt in the form of business debt that's making us money in the first place, we are effectively eroding our own debt. It's like printing our own money, right?
I'm with you. So absolutely.
That's why I like good debt. Now, you ask, is there a limit? I don't know that there's a limit. I would say that there's a limit in the amount you should be leveraged in a particular deal. Like, for example, right now, if you're buying real estate, probably not a good idea to be leveraged more than, 60%, 65, 70% LTV. Not a good time to buy something, 10%. 15% down. And I'm talking about larger assets. I don't buy single family homes, but talking about, multifamily, 100 unit, 200 unit type buildings, et cetera.
Well, the thing that I think that's so fascinating to me about this argument, I think there's great points on every side, is I do think that there's a point that many physicians get trapped in where they get into the real estate game to start out with. And there may be cash flowing on a property, either negative cash flow, if they're doing individual real estate deals, like we're talking about single family homes, or they're positive cash, like $100 or $200 a month, if they're lucky. And to me, that is practically a form of bad debt when you have several of those things.
Well, if you're not cash flowing, it's bad debt, period. Because by definition, if your yield is less than your interest rate, you're amplifying losses. You're not even, you're not even breaking even.
Well, that's my point, right? Is that there is a point at which good debt is bad, right?
Right, but that's not the amount of debt you have. Well, that is, you could have $1 billion of debt and have that not be the case. You're talking about simply not leveraging in a good way.
Right. Exactly. So I completely think you're right that good debt can be good, but I think a lot of people get trapped in thinking, I have to buy real estate, right, in order to make it happen, but they're not crunching their numbers to figure out what does it take to cash flow the thing.
There's no question about that. I think, a big part of, what I do now is, listen, there's a lot of people who understand the power of what real estate or other real assets potentially can have for them. But as you said, they're physicians and maybe they don't have a lot of time to learn this, or maybe they're just not interested, but they like what most people at the end of the day, who even are big real estate people like myself, it's not that we're in love with real estate. We're in love with what real estate can do for us, right? And there's a big difference. And if you identify that and you realize that, then you say, how can I do this in a way that I don't really have to, I don't have to be an expert. And so part of, big part of what I do now is through syndications. And I don't know if you've ever talked about that on the show, but that is, in my opinion, that is the best way, single best way for physicians and other high paid professionals who don't have time to learn about this stuff, but who are interested in it, to actually get involved with real estate.
Well, and I think it's a much more passive way to do it. We talk about passive income. I like Robert Allen's definition, residual income. when you have single family homes or you do what I'm doing with some of my crazy stuff with the land business. You know, I think the nice thing about syndicated deals is that they really are passive. The bad news is now you're having to trust someone else to do the work on that. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on how do you know who's what's a good deal, what's a bad deal? You know, if you were starting all over knowing what you know now, you know, you have very little cash, how would you be thinking about partnering with people on syndicated deals?
Okay, so that's a very good question, because not only can I tell you what I would do, I will tell you what I did do. Because when I started out, so one of the books I read to figure out how real estate worked, after I read Kiyosaki, I read ABCs of Real Estate from Ken McElroy, who's now a friend of mine. And it's really neat to, you know, have a guy who, you know, I learned real estate from has ultimately become friends. But so Kenny wrote this book, and he wrote that, and he wrote ABCs of Advanced Real Estate or something like that, a couple of those Rich Dad books, and I read them. And they told us about the math, and the math is really quite easy, right? And so Kenny made it look so easy in his book that I went out and bought a building in 2009, you know, 2010, as soon as I could afford one. But man, it is hard to lose money if you bought real estate in 2009, 2010. But guess what? I did it, and I lost a good chunk of money there. And the reason, I won't go into too much detail, is they didn't understand fundamentally that it's not just about the numbers. It's about knowing everything else around the numbers. The numbers are just, you know, are where you get to after you get past due diligence, after you get past team, and everything else. Because the numbers, you can't trust them until you get to that point. Now, the second two apartment buildings I bought, I had become friendly with a guy who I was invested in his fund. It was a private placement fund, and he and I used to talk business. I was starting a couple of businesses at the time, and he was in the mortgage business. And he brought a couple buildings to me, and he said, "Listen, I got this guy once out, and I know the guy, I know the deal. It's legit. I've underwritten it myself. Take a look." I did the numbers, got to know my friend pretty well, and I was like, you know what? Everything looks good. I'm not going to quit on this. The next thing you know, not only did I make money on those deals, but I made more than we underwrote it for. And I'm, you know, this is back in like 2011 or so now. I'm $1 million ahead on each one of those buildings in terms of equity.
Wow.
So, ding, 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 ding. Okay, I get it. Now, what I get now is that investing is a team sport. Okay. Investing in real estate, investing in real assets is a team sport. So the next thing that I decided to do at that point was say, okay, from now on, when I invest, I am going to only invest with people who I know, like, and trust. And I call that tribal investing. And that is fundamentally what has taken me from 2009 to having, you know, a negative net worth to having a mid eight-figure net worth now. That single principle of tribal investing, because that's how the wealthy do it. That's how the uber wealthy do it. They don't go out and, you know, somebody sent me a deal on the email and it looks pretty good, and hey, maybe, man, I got a deal, that kind of thing. I only invest with professionals. I don't invest with people who are throwing together a deal. And by the way, I've got a full-time job. And so what happens with this whole tribal investing approach is this. It's, first of all, it's like a community, right? And there's checks and balances as well. People know that they have to perform, and word gets around when people perform. And if they don't perform, or they don't do well, or they've done something, that for whatever reason, they can get kicked out of that community. And when I've stuck to my guns on that, I've only made money. Of course, that's my story, right?
Well, and I think it's a great story, and it's one that you really had to scrap and claw for the last, what, 10, 14 years. And I guess one of the things that I see with physicians, you know, often, you know, in the operating room or in the lounge or wherever doctors are congregating, you know, these kind of things are talked about, right? And it's where sometimes those things go great, but other times when you get curbsided, you know, it might just be bad tips that that are being kind of shown around too. So how would you differentiate picking your tribe? You know, what kind of characteristics to avoid bad deals, which maybe you have to hit some bad deals along the way to get to good ones, but how would you be thinking about that if you're starting all over to find your tribe today?
Well, first of all, like, I think, listen, this stuff is not, it's not brain surgery, right? I mean, what I mean by that is, at the end of the day, it's a relationship thing, right? Business is a relationship thing, and so is investing. It's all about relationships. So where can you go to create those relationships, or how do you do it? Well, I can tell you from, you know, with my own community, I have 700 accredited investors in my community. A good chunk of them are physicians. You know, and that's certainly one community. We've learned to kind of trust each other. But at the end of the day, one of the easiest things to do is try to find other people who you trust who've had really good experiences. I mean, that's probably the most basic way. I can tell you that, you know, I started investing with Ken McElroy as a private investor, and Ken is great. He's got tremendous integrity. And then a team that I work with now is pretty active. I was watching them and their performance for a couple of years saying, wow, these guys are doing great. And then one day Ken told me that he knew the guy and that he thought he was really smart and he thought he was a great guy and he's known him for decades. Well, that means a lot to me because Ken means a lot to me. Like Ken's word mean a lot to me, right? So this is, as cliche as it may sound, it's all about relationships. So trying to find your tribe, trying to find people who have had good experiences. And I'm not talking about the one-off. I'm talking about, you know, I still learn about them these days, right? I'll have somebody in my investor group and says, you know, I invested with the same group for the last 5 or 6 years, and they've performed extremely well. They've beat pro formas. That's when I say, hey, can you do me a favor? Send me an intro, right? That's what I do. So again, I just don't think that investing has to be as complicated as sometimes it's made out to be. I wouldn't look at just pro formas because anybody can make a pro forma look good.
Yes, they can. Yes, they can.
I can make some swampland in Florida look good for you if you give me an Excel data sheet and you know, and some fancy glossy photos. It's just not going to happen. The way, if you think about it, you know, one of the things that I've been doing for the last few years is feel like I've been really trying to study the uber wealthy. Like, how do the really wealthy families, family offices, et cetera, you know, how do they allocate their funds? And really, it just comes down to a lot of this sort of, you know, no like and trust. They're like these little circles of these family offices that are investing in a lot of the same things. It's just that, you know, most of us who are in the world of, you know, even in the mid six figures, even though we're making, you know, doctors are making more money than most people, they still tend to invest like the poor and middle class, you know? And I just think it's possible to do things differently. And that's my perspective now. And I also don't think it's more complicated because I think sometimes doctors get scared away from real estate or real asset investing in general because they think, well, gosh, I don't have the time or the ability to do that. Well, gosh, you're a smart person. If you spent just a little bit of time trying to learn some fundamentals, it might make sense for you to at least diversify what you've got going on right now.
Right. Well, I think there's a lot of great points there. I think what I would add to that, I'm curious to get your thoughts on it. One of the things that really attracted to me about the land business was a relatively small amount of capital, very small amount of capital, right, to buy land. You know, I bought pieces of property for $300, $400, $500, $1,000, and I could be diversified among many different pieces and then turn around and sell them to get an income stream. So it was not a whole lot of risk for each parcel. That's one of the things I think people struggle with and many physicians struggle with is that many of these syndicated deals, you know, in order to get familiar with it, you have to lay down a lot more capital. At least that's the way I think about it, 25, 50, 100K at a time. You know, it's not a small investment.
You're right. And here's the difference, right? What you're talking about with the land business, I'm very familiar with it. We were talking about it offline. That's a business, right? So there's a difference between a business and investing. And, you know, a land business is a business. It's going to take time. It's going to require some operations. It's going to require a lot of these things. Same thing goes for real estate flippers. They're not investing in real estate. They're in the business of flipping real estate, and wholesalers, the same thing. What I'm talking about is buying assets. You know, it's the slow cook. And so it is a completely different thing. Now, in syndications, you're right. First of all, if you're going to get involved, you have to be, you know, you have to have a physician salary, basically, right? But, you know, I don't, frankly, it's to me, the idea of investing $25,000, $50,000 at a time, I mean, I don't consider that terribly expensive. $25,000 at a time, I think most physicians can handle that. Especially if you've got $1 million or something sitting over in a brokerage account. So for me, I don't look at that as a big barrier to entry, because I think of it as a stable investment. Real estate is a stable investment, right? It is not a business.
I hear you. Fair enough. Well, I'd love to know, Buck, as we start to wrap up for today, as you reflect back, you know, you get picked up the Kiyosaki book, the cash flow quadrants. What do you think is the biggest mistake that you've made, and how has that impacted you?
Well, I mean, if you're just talking about in finances, the biggest mistake I made was also the best thing could have happened to me, in that I bought a building without really, doing it with a team approach, and I lost about $300,000, on that building. And I mean, I consider that very, very, very expensive education, but an education that ultimately, you know, 100x'd what I lost. So it's not, you know, you have to look at these things as learning experiences. And so yes. I don't really look at it as something that I necessarily would have done differently. It was part of my journey. And, I think the thing that I learned most there, and I think in life in general, I think this is true, that if you're going to venture out into, a dark cave, bring somebody who's been there before and, who has a flashlight. Because listen, I mean, you could do nothing. And the reality is, you can just do what everybody else does. And we don't have to get into that. But obviously, you know, that's not my approach at all. But you can also, you know, see if there's things that might interest you and get in interested. And I think you just have to approach it as a team. If you approach it with the team, whether that's through coaching, just through colleagues who are doing it, you'll compress time. And even though it takes mistakes to learn these things, they don't have to be your mistakes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Learning from other people's mistakes, one of the best things we can do. Any books you're reading right now that you might recommend to us to check out?
I've had a lot of time to just try to think about different things in life. There's financial wealth, but you know, I've also been interested in trying to work on every other aspect of my life. And people who are physicians in particular tend to sometimes, you know, be go, 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 and never sit back and enjoy everything. And I've got three little girls, they're 9, 5, and 3. So I've been involved with transcendental meditation for a while. And so there's a book out right now that I think, Strength in Stillness, I think Bob Roth, talks about transcendental meditation and how it can potentially really change your life. And I strongly advocate those kinds of things, because we have to look out for ourselves outside of just money. And so that's a big part of what I call holistic wealth. And that's what I just finished. So
awesome. Awesome. Well, I would love to know, where can we find you, Buck? Where's the podcast? Where can people learn more about you?
Well, there's a Wealth Formula podcast, which is where you can find pretty much anywhere where you find podcasts, iTunes, Stitcher, on YouTube as well. Wealthformula.com, where you can also, you know, find a lot of the resources. You know, I have a book which was an Amazon number one bestseller called Seven Secrets of Eternal Wealth. You could download that there, or you can even just text me 44222. And if you text that number and put in wealth formula, one word, then you can get a copy of that book if you want. If you want to learn how I approach a very basic way that I approach money, that would be a good place to start probably.
I love it. I love it. Perfect. Well, thank you for those resources. And Buck, you know, there's so much that I'd love to cover, but we don't have time. Any closing thoughts you want to leave us with?
No, I think, you know, I'd be great if anybody wants to come out and check out what we talk about. Again, it's a very different perspective from a lot of things that you hear from some of the other physicians in the investing community, like White Coat Investor, et cetera. But, you know, then again, I don't just cater to doctors. I cater to, you know, all hardworking professionals, and we'd love to, you know, whether you like it or not, check it out.
Perfect. All right. Hear it, everyone. Go to wealthformula.com. Check out about Buck and everything he's going on. And, you know, a lot of us talk about wanting to retire early and make it there. And he has done that, no longer practicing medicine, obviously, anymore, that he's comfortable enough that he could do what he's doing right now. So, my friends, that wraps it up for today. In the next podcast, I'd love to hear from you, hear about your story, things you're struggling with, things that you would count as successes. Make sure to contact me, Dave, at drfreedompodcast.com, or hit up the website, drfreedompodcast.com. For the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, this is Dave Denniston. And remember, my friends, remember to slash your debt, slash your taxes, and live a liberated lifestyle. All right, my friends. Well, that was the show for today. I hope you loved it. And I just want to give you one more reminder. My newest book, The Young Physician's Guide to Money and Life, is available right now. $25. You get the sun, the moon, the stars, all kinds of bonuses, $100 worth of priceless knowledge. Are you ready to go and pick this book up? If so, you're going to want to get it from me and get all those bonuses by texting DocBook, that's DocBook, to 44222, or going to the website drfreedompodcast.com/DocBook. Again, snag your copy now by texting DocBook, that's all one word, to 44222, or going to drfreedompodcast.com/DocBook.